Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to the Worse Than Marxism edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Fusion. I'm joined, as ever, by Jordan Weissman of Slate Magazine.
Hello.
I'm in Berlin, of all places. He is in the Slate headquarters with
me,
our stand-in.
Oh my gosh,
it's me. so we have the most awesome stand-in for Kathy O'Neill. Stand-in, would you please introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Lynette Lopez. I'm the senior finance correspondent at Business Insider. Sometimes I talk to Felix, and so he invited me. It was all very casual.
Long-standing casual acquaintance. But we also, Lynette, you want to plug your podcast. That's what you do.
When you get on other podcasts, you plug your podcast. My podcast is called Hard Pass. It's with a young man named Joshua Barrow, who you might see on MSNBC. He also writes for Business Insider. And our podcast is much shorter than this one. It's only 6 to 8 minutes. And it's called Hard Pass, as I said. Rejecting the business of everyday life. We talk about, you know, business, finance, markets, money.
Not so different in that case from Slate Money, except for in much more bite-sized digestible chunks.
Efficient.
We have three bite-sized digestible chunks for you, as ever, this week. We are going to talk about hedge funds and why they seem to be losing their luster. We are going to talk about active management, or passive investing, rather, and whether it is worse than Marxism, as a research report says. But mostly, or at least first, we are going to talk about the crazy drug price scandal of the week. We have a new Martin Shkreli this week, do we not, Lynette Lopez?
Yes, and the new Martin is a lady. Her name is Heather Bresch.
And this is equal opportunity evil.
Yeah, room. Anybody can Martin Shkreli. Anybody can Martin Shkreli.
I don't know if they can do it the same verb as Martin Shkreli, though. That's the question.
I don't know, but ever since this political campaign started, do you know what I keep asking myself? Remember when we thought Martin Shkreli was the worst America had to offer?
Yeah.
Ugh. Things are just so dark. And now we have another.
Have you found someone worse than Martin Shkreli?
This woman might be worse than Martin Shkreli. Okay.
Okay, so who is this woman and what
is her name? Is Heather Bresch. She's the CEO of Mylan.
What is Mylan?
Mylan is the pharmaceutical company that owns, distributes, sells EpiPen, which is the drug that stops people from having allergic reactions from their throat closing up. You know an EpiPen. You accidentally eat a peanut, stick it in your skin, you don't die. You get to the hospital, you get treated, you're good to go. It's a life-saving thing, and Mylan bought the drug in 2007, and since then, the price of the drug has increased by about 500%. So now
it's gone up from, like, what, $50 to $600, something like that?
Yeah, now the retail price of the drug is $608. Most people pay out-of-pocket around $300 for the drug, and that's where this outrage is coming from. You know, kids are going back to school, and Mylan has really spent a shit ton of money on getting EpiPen into schools, into parents' hands, encouraging everyone that they need to have it, like dentist's office need to have it in their emergency pack, like all this stuff. They're doing a deal with Disney World to make sure that all the hotels and resorts have EpiPen on deck. This is a huge outreach for them. They haven't really innovated the product very much.
The product hasn't improved. The product has also not become any more expensive to manufacture.
No. But it's still about $3 to manufacture an EpiPen.
The cost of manufacture is $3. The cost to the consumer is $608. And what's also fascinating to me is now you and I and everyone else knows what happens to emergency kits, wherever they are, whether they're in schools or bathrooms or at Disney Worlds or whatever, is they just sit there gathering dust most of the time. And once in a while, someone will try and get a Band-Aid from it. But the one thing which you're very unlikely to do in any given year is actually use the EpiPen in any given emergency kit. And most of the time, when you're dealing with emergency kits, that's no big deal. You know, the medicine, the bandages, the Band-Aids and everything else in the emergency kit just sit there. But
EpiPen expires after a year, so you got to replace it if you're going to be up to code. I think that's what our Felix Salmon is trying to get at here.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it so uniquely evil, that they're trying to spread it around the world in a way that forces people to throw out $600 worth of EpiPens every year and replace them with a new EpiPen, which they're equally unlikely to use.
So, and here's the deal. So yesterday, Heather Bresch got on CNBC to try to explain herself. Nobody really bought the shit, but okay, she tried. She said, hey, you know, the medicine is just too much regulation. It goes through three or four hands before, you know, it gets to the consumer. That's too much. Our health system is broken, which she has a point. It's broken, just not for the reasons that she's insisting.
She's the person breaking it.
She's breaking it. And she says, you know, we have a system that incentivizes us to raise prices. No, honey. It incentivizes you to make money like any business. But no one told you to raise the price of an EpiPen 500%. Nobody told you.
I thought that interview was really interesting because in the course of saying some incredibly tone-deaf things and making a generally invalid, not very convincing point, she did actually point to some, she did actually gesture towards some real issues. And that is that, you know, there are multiple villains here. She was trying to argue that Mylan itself is not really a villain in this case, that it's not doing anything wrong. I don't think she managed to say anything convincing there.
No.
But what she did actually, and what Mylan has maybe kind of, in a way, it's almost, it's, you know, pulling away the curtain from all the other players in this industry.
Sure.
And saying, look at all these other people who are taking a cut of this $600 that you're paying. You know, one of them, for instance, is this group of companies called Pharmacy Benefit Managers, right?
Right, of course.
And that this is a group of companies that, you know, there are companies like Express Scripts, CVS actually is one now. There's one from United Health. That most consumers don't really think much about.
I think of them as the gatekeepers between the drug companies and the insurers. Because
yeah.
The insurers ultimately have to pay the bill for these drugs, and the PBMs say, yes, this passes, no. They're like the Gandalf, you shall not pass.
They're the middlemen. And the thing about their business model is, I don't want to get too ornate here, but basically it's taking a cut of the drug as it passes from the manufacturer to the patient. That's really, you know, it's something called spread pricing, where there's a difference between the amount they pay the manufacturer and what then gets passed on to the insurer or the company that insures its employees. But the point being is there are these middlemen who are in some ways probably driving up drug prices. You know, PBMs will say, well, our job is actually to drive down the prices,
right? They
by
make
getting
sure that
discounts.
They but, make sure that you get the lowest price.
But
for
because there's
drug.
So much little transparency.
Yeah, we have no idea what's going on.
Exactly. We don't really know what's going on. And so Mylan,
okay, so
on the,
wait, hang on.
Yeah.
Jordan, before we disappear completely down this PBM rabbit hole.
Oh my God, it's such a hole.
Well, so
yeah,
what I'm
so
saying. Well,
so
the big picture here is that on the one hand, you have this company, Mylan, that is profiting by jacking up drug prices, right? And suddenly, and they did a very bad job hiding it. You know, what they're doing now is giving everyone this coupon for $300 so they won't have to pay as much out of pocket.
And we need to talk about that because that is some thievery.
If they were being smart, they would have done that early because it would have hidden the whole game they play in for the pharmaceutical industry is hiding the actual cost of the drugs from the patients. They make their money off of insurers for the most part. And so
the
goal is to make sure people don't realize how much money is getting passed, how much is getting charged to the system. They didn't do that. So now there's this outrage. However, in their kind of flailing attempts to save their own image, they're kind of exposing that there are all these other systemic problems. And I think that's fascinating.
And what I
hang on a second. I just wanted, because I still don't quite understand what Jordan said here. Are you saying that there's a systemic problem with pharmacy benefit managers?
Yeah, I think they're probably.
There's a systemic problem with the relationship between pharmacy benefit managers, insurers, and drug companies. There's a lot of collusion, opacity, and things that Elizabeth Warren referred to in an April congressional hearing as kickbacks. I mean, you can't play this game with government insurers. You can only do it with private insurers. And there's a reason for that, as Warren pointed out, and that's because it would be illegal. Now, here's the thing about these patient assistance programs, coupons, whatever, that
I want you to refer to this while using the phrase as a mom.
As a mom. Oh,
oh
my
yeah,
God.
We have to really talk about that.
Yeah, that's the one that hit my gag reflex yesterday while Brush was
priceless.
On CNBC. As a mom, I know how important EpiPen is.
Well,
and
she
then
also
I,
said she
and
was,
then I gagged.
She said nobody was more frustrated about this than me.
Nobody. But then at the end of the interview, when she was asked point blank, are you going to raise the price of EpiPen? She was like, we're just going to work with Congress. It's like, just say you're going to raise the price. Just say it. Because you know what I know? Here's what we know. Here's what we know about Heather Brush's compensation. We know that about over 80% of it is tied to incentives to stock or to earnings per share incentives. And there's a big payday for her in March of 2018, if she can get her company's earnings per share where it sits at a little below $5 in 2015 up to $6 now. Or $6 in 2017, 2018. So she has a huge incentive here to really like blow the business out of the water, really hit a home run here. And the issue is the rest of the portfolio is not that interesting. Most of the gains that Mylan has made have been by jacking up the price of EpiPen. So
And what we have to appreciate is that right now the poor woman is scraping by on a mere $18 million a year. And if she wants to actually make a respectable amount of money, she's
right.
going to have to raise the price of EpiPen even more than she's raised it already. Because, I
exactly.
mean, it's not easy getting by on $18 million a year.
Exactly. And she stands to gain about like $75,000 shares or something in the company if she hits that $6 mark. Like, you know, it's quite an incentive to really, you know, blow this out of the water. And what's really going to help her do that are these patient assistance programs that she's touting as help for the consumer. What they really do is allow drug companies to maintain price. The consumer's like, you know what? I'm not paying anything, so I'm not going to complain about this. But the insurers are still footing the bill on the other side. And the American people have to deal with higher insurance premiums across the board because of how expensive the drugs that we don't know that we're taking are. Does that make sense? Because I'm confused.
That makes perfect sense to me. And then the other thing is that EpiPen is like with exactly what I was talking about with this idea that most of the time it just sits in boxes and gathers dust and then gets thrown away because it's expired. EpiPen is a classic example of us writing prescriptions or just simply buying way more drugs than we really need. There's been a huge increase in the amount of EpiPens sold over the past few years. Mylar has been good at that. And there has been no particular decrease in the amount of deaths associated with anaphylactic shock.
Well, they're so like, rare to begin with. It's
yeah,
a really
I mean,
low
this
base.
Is
but
crazy
that, that's
talk.
I will. So I want to push back on that a tiny bit. As someone who's gone through anaphylactic shock,
babe.
And who does carry an EpiPen, it ain't fun. Like I've been there. You know, on the hospital bed, getting the IVs and stuff, and trying to deal with it. Like it's a scary experience. The threat of it, if a parent knows there is something that could prevent their kid from even potentially maybe going through that experience, I don't think it's a bad thing to have these things widely available and distributed. The problem is, again, in the U.S., we pay $600 or you go to Canada and you get it for $11.
This so is crazy talk.
The idea of distributing these things en masse is not a bad idea. It's just the price of this particular drug.
And are you ready to be outraged?
Capitalism. And this is why
outraged?
We're calling this I'll be outraged in a second, but this
okay.
is why we're calling it the worst than Marxism edition. It's because under capitalism, normally if you produce a lot more of something, the price goes down. It's only in this weird kind of pharma world
totally.
Where you can produce a lot more of something and the price goes up. But yes, Lynette, wrap us up here.
So what Brush said on CNBC yesterday was that the thing is, you know, America's high drug prices are subsidizing lower drug prices for the rest of the world.
Which is true, but
which is false.
Well, to some extent.
But what the heck?
Yeah.
No, we're not. Yes, our high drug prices for R&D, if we're awarding companies for innovation, yes, we are subsidizing those. But if your only innovation that you're bringing to a drug is to market it and put it in the hands of dentists and inside of like pharmaceutical kit or emergency kits at Disney World, no, that is bullshit.
I think that there's some exaggeration there, but I do agree.
There's no exaggeration.
No.
I'm not kidding.
on her part saying like, oh, well, we're doing this, you know, the U.S. people are doing this great, you know, benevolent thing for the rest of the world. That's it. I think there is a lot of agreement that if the U.S. were to significantly lower its own drug prices, prices in the rest of the world probably would come up to meet ours a bit.
I think EpiPen is a classic counterexample to that. And that the prices in the rest of the world are much closer to the kind of prices that we would have in the U.S. if, for instance, the government was allowed to negotiate drug prices, which they're not allowed to negotiate because Republicans. And
Democrats, too.
And there's no real evidence that... I mean, there's two very different statements. One is American drug prices are higher than in the rest of the world. And then the other one is that there's a subsidy there. And the first is true, but the second one just is not.
I mean, I've been covering Valiant for the last 2.5 years. And the inflation, those inflated prices that Americans are paying for a stupid toe fungus drug that Valiant was selling, those don't subsidize shit for the rest of the world.
That is absolutely true.
Like, what are you talking about?
That is absolutely true. When you're in that, yes.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
So the next topic, we talk about hedge funds a lot on Slate Money, but Jordan, what is the asset class as a whole up to these days? And is everyone finally waking up to the fact that they're a miserable place to put your money?
Rip off!
Felix, I thought we agreed that... I'm certain that we agreed on this show that hedge funds are a compensation scheme that have passed themselves off as an asset class.
Compensate? Well, it's not. I mean, it's not unique to hedge funds. It's
oh,
also
I've never been
people.
On this.
They have the same compensation scheme.
Wait. I've never been on this show, but... Yes, absolutely.
In any of
yes,
that's the most enthusiastic.
That is so true. The 2 and 20 is they shouldn't be called hedge funds. They should be called 2 and 20s.
Yeah. So it's a not very good year for hedge funds. Bloomberg is reporting that there is the largest withdrawal from hedge funds since 2008 and 2009. It's about $25 billion getting pulled out of them. And they are currently, if current trends continue, on pace to have the first net withdrawals from hedge funds as a whole since the financial crisis and the immediate aftermath thereof. And why is that happening? It's because they're tending to lose money this year.
Yeah.
A lot. Hedge funds are not performing especially well. And Lynette, I know you've been writing about this idea that it appears... hedge fund managers as sort of a group are just out of ideas. It's like they've resorted to investing in Microsoft.
They've resorted to investing in Morgan Stanley.
Yeah.
How much money can you squeeze out of flailing Morgan Stanley? Okay. So here's the thing. Yeah. When I was traveling around the United States in May for what is conference season on Wall Street, my first stop was the Milken Global Conference, where Steve Cohen, formerly the founder of SAC Capital, now known as Point72, sat on a panel with a bunch of his peers, and there was some self-flagellation going on. You know, these guys were like, you know, there are too many guys in the market. We can't make money. February was really scary. Mom, help. Like, it was very disturbing to watch his Masters of the Universe say, you know, this market is just too tough for us. It's just too challenging. But one of the things that they've been blaming all of this on is the fact that there are more hedge funds in this country than there are Taco Bells. And they want all the old school guys. What they want is just the younger guys to get the fuck out. Like, do not pass go. Do not collect $200. See yourself to jail.
Well, is that such a unreasonable
it's
feeling?
It's so hilarious.
I feel like, but, you know, isn't kind of the proliferation of hedge funds actually part of the problem? That
it is.
What might have, you know, was essentially the idea is you would have these small investment shops that really did have some sort of edge are now giving, now when it becomes trendy, it's, you know, like.
And they're all sharing their ideas together. Yeah. They all go to the same conferences. I mean, some of them are all in the same buildings. It's like, then you have situations like Valeant Pharmaceuticals where a stock is a hedge fund parking lot. And when it loses 90% because nobody did their homework, because no one has any ideas anymore, they're just cribbing off everyone else. Well, then everybody else hits the floor.
So, so that's interesting. Is it possible that we're actually seeing like more correlation between hedge funds now because they're all sitting in a room talking to each other?
Absolutely.
And so when it is becoming an asset class.
And when you talk to the old school guys about comp, I know some of the, you know, great, the best top guys in this industry, they're still charging 1 in 20, 1 1/4 in 20. And these are the older school guys. It was about 2005, 2006, where you haven't had another wave of hedge funds starting. These guys were the ones who were like, you know what? Two and 20. How is that enough? Let's do 3 and 25. Fuck it. Why not? YOLO. Just like do it.
Five
and they
and 45.
Did.
Well, I mean, Jim Simons is 5 and 45, right? Something
well,
crazy
he's,
like that.
He's insane. That's insane. And, you know, I would say, I think Einhorn is 1 1/4 in 20. Chainos
so,
is
so the
1
question
in
which
20.
I have is this a function, Lynette, of just so much, like, the once upon a time, as Jordan was saying, hedge funds were small. And now they're big. And that once upon a time, you know, you would run $1 billion and be like, oh my God, I have $1 billion. And now there are these huge companies with names like OxZiff, where no one really knows who they even
are.
Oh
my God, they're
and they're running like
so
$100 billion. And it's just so much money that you can't put it all to work in the opportunities. There's just not that much opportunity out there.
One of my favorite hedge fund managers, I was talking to him after Brexit, and he has his fund, I think $15 billion or something. And he was like, you know, Lynette, he tracks like a 25-year-old drug dealer. He was like, Lynette, I just got too much paper. I can't move all this paper right now. I don't know what to do with it. And I was like, that's hilarious. But this seems like a problem I'll never understand. What I do understand, though... What I do understand is that hedge fund at some point stopped being an investment scheme or even a compensation scheme. It's now it became a brand. And so you would say, I'm running a hedge fund. And people would say, you know what? No questions asked. Here's my money. Please double it. Thank you very much. I'm going to go over here now. And when I read your investor letter, I'll check in. Like, that is how guys like ValueAct, who were some of the big losers in the nasty Valeant takedown that has been happening since October, that's how they get away with having no benchmark. They don't have to compare their returns to anything or anyone. And that's how they get away with then telling their investors, you know what's our really smart idea? Do you know what's our alpha play? Do you know what we think is going to beat the market? Handing Morgan Stanley $1 billion. Like, what are you talking about? Why don't
Wait,
I it, just
It's
purchase-
worse than that. They're not even handing Morgan Stanley $1 billion. And we're going to come to this in the next segment. But what they're doing is they're handing someone with $1 billion worth of Morgan Stanley stock $1 billion.
Yeah.
And saying, we're just going to buy this stock off you. And how that helps anyone or how that like has any salutary effects on anyone or anything is beyond me.
Why don't you just get into your E-Trade account, log in, and buy some frickin' Morgan Stanley
so
stock? How about that?
So I have a question. Are hedge funds to some degree suffering from some of the same problems that maybe Wall Street did a few years ago, where you just eventually you become institutionalized, you become sort of a stop on the path for Ivy League graduates and business school grads?
No, I don't think that's
don't
what's
think
happening
that's
here.
That's not at all. Okay.
I think what's happening here is, as one of my favorite hedgies from Chicago said, this guy James Latinsky, there's about to be a Venezuela for asset classes, which is like, I was like, okay, that is the most rich people problem I've ever heard. And like, Venezuela doesn't deserve that. But what he's talking about is just things that are actually worth anything mm-hmm. are very, very rare. Things that are actually priced correctly are very rare because we're in this low interest rate environment where the actual value of asset classes is incredibly distorted. So these guys who are actually looking for alpha, looking for value, are seeing stocks whose earnings are declining, businesses that don't seem to be, you know, don't seem to be generating that much revenue. And yet their stocks are going up and up and up. Nobody knows when this is going to stop. Things are looking expensive. And so when people find something that they think might actually be worth something, it's like a rush towards that. And that has really impacted hedge funds.
So in a way, information is travels too fast. It's hard. No, well, getting, no it's too efficient.
No, there's not enough good stuff out there.
But also it means that what you're saying also is that essentially hedge funds used to be secretive, right?
Right.
And now there is no more secret. So this market has become more efficient.
It's partly that, but it's mainly just that there's no... It used to be that you'd look at the market and there would be a bunch of different companies and assets which all had differing sort of value propositions, and you'd be like, which one has the best value proposition? That's the one I want to go into. And now you look at the market and no one has a decent value proposition, and you're like, you're all overpriced. And it kind of makes sense. It's intuitive that in that kind of a market, it's harder to generate alpha.
Yeah. And these guys are all feeling it, even the most brilliant of them. And, you know, it sucks because, you know, America used to think you guys were smart, but now you look like a bunch of dummies.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
So talking about a bunch of dummies, I need to talk, just to wrap this thing up, about this wonderful Sanford Bernstein report that came out this week, which everyone has had a field day with, which I'm sure was the intent, which said that passive investing is worse than Marxism. And passive investing, of course, is kind of the opposite of hedge funds. And how much would we love this report on a scale of like 1 to 10, Lynette?
A gajillion trillion.
I'm so at 11 on this. I'm going to sort of try to defend it. I'm going to give it my best shot.
No,
a little bit. Someone has to.
Someone How are you going to do step, this to me?
Step up to the plate. Okay, so Felix, you want to first like lay out their theory a little bit?
Yeah.
Okay, so the theory is that as regular Slate Money listeners will know, passive investing is basically the gospel according to sensible people, which is that there's no way you are going to be able to go in there and be smarter than the market as a whole. Even professional money managers, as we've just heard, can't outperform the market. So the chances that you're going to be able to are about zero. So given that the market is over the long term a sensible place to invest rather than just putting your money in under the mattress, what you should do is just buy the market as a whole, buy the index and set it and forget it, and then wake up 40 years later with a pension fund. That is great, except for, according to Sanford Bernstein, the problem is that they've taken this to this kind of extreme sort of reductio ad absurdum, where they're saying, what if everybody did this? Then there would be no one driving one stock up or down relative to another stock. You know, companies could come out with monster earnings and the share price wouldn't move because passive investors don't react to earnings reports. You know, theoretically, a company could like declare bankruptcy and the stock price wouldn't move because passive investors don't react to bankruptcy declarations. And, and that you'd just have a bunch of massive mispricings in the market and nothing would react to anything, and the market wouldn't do its job of capital allocation.
And then he swooned and we all got him his smelling salts. Yeah. And he was like, ah, okay. Vapors.
So we picked him off his divan. And
yeah,
exactly. So, okay, here's the defense I'm going to try to mount, because someone ought to.
Oh, God.
First, yes, this is a thought experiment, just to give people a sense. Like, you know, we're nowhere near the entire stock market being under passive management. I think the last I saw is it's a third of assets or something, which is a lot.
Though assets are flowing toward passive management.
Because of things.
As they should be.
As they should be. However, one thing people worry about is that as more people just buy index, stocks are just going to move together and they're going to be correlated with one another, right?
Right.
So there is some research out there that does, academic research suggesting that this actually might not be that great for the way markets allocate capital. Like, this is not a crazy idea they've come up with. There's a paper I found, for instance, from the Journal of Financial Economics from around, I think it's 2000, a Yale professor named Jeffrey Wergler. He looked at this. He looked at 65 countries. And what he found was that countries where there was less synchronicity between stocks, where stocks reflected the information about individual companies supposedly more so, the investors did a better job by his measure of allocating capital. And the measure he used was basically how much money was flowing to industries where value added was rising, which is, I think, it's basically, you know, who's innovating the most. Who's
so can I jump in here?
Can I jump in here? 2000,
no, I'm gonna let you jump in a second, Lynette.
Okay,
because
fine.
I just want to do this thing first, which is this idea, which is absolutely central to the Sanford Bernstein report and to this particular argument, that the main or even the primary job of the markets is capital allocation, and that did definitely used to be true. But now, as we've seen, when hedge funds give $1 billion to a company, they don't actually give $1 billion to the company. They just give $1 billion to someone else who owned the shares before them. And the main way that companies are raising capital these days is actually in the private markets more than it is in the public markets. You don't see that many stock offerings. The number of IPOs is down. The number of secondary offerings is down. And while the number of bond offerings is up, the stock market is just not a way where it's not a place anymore that companies compete to see who has the higher share price so that they can raise money the cheapest.
You and I have had this conversation before, and I fundamentally agree with a lot of that. I do think that the stock market and prices also, you know, what's happening in the stock market and the sectors that are thriving there do probably filter down to some extent to the rest of the economy and to the sorts of businesses that are getting private funding. I haven't seen anyone formally look at that, but that is my feeling about things. It's not like tech. It's not like the venture capital world is booming and tech stock prices aren't. There is a connection.
But that's exactly what we saw. Just a couple of years ago, we saw exactly that. The venture capital world booming and tech stocks trading on their lowest multiples of all time. But yes, Lynette.
I think what we really need to pay attention here is the fact that, one, it's ridiculous, the idea that there will never be any active management. There will always be people who want to pay a premium for alpha. There will probably just be fewer of them, and they'll probably get paid less, which means that they'll have less money to have this clown write a paper about the Marxism and passive investing. I mean, what we're looking at here is not what talking about indexing taking over the market is so extreme. But I think that we're also forgetting one of the greatest old man fights in financial television here over passive and active investing between Larry Fink and Carl Icahn on national television, who screamed at each other basically at a conference. I believe it was last year or 2 years ago in CNBC, the Delivering Alpha conference. Carl Icahn told Larry Fink that he was taking basically passive investing was taking the world into hell. Larry Fink clutched his pearls and said, "You are a knave." And Carl Icahn was like, "So what?" And it was really awkward and very uncomfortable. But you're talking about two very different sides of Wall Street here. Icahn is known as this corporate raider, you know, legendary 1980s hedge fund figure, very aggressive trader, tells people they're crybabies on TV. And then Larry Fink is this, like, I want to be Treasury Secretary. I run $6 trillion. How much is in
It's insane. And the large chunk of that was when he bought Barclays iShares out of, you know, the financial crisis. And that's where about half of his AUM, assets under management, comes from. And that's why he's now having to defend passive management, because iShares are all of these index ETFs, which are passive management. I think I just want to tie this conversation up, though, by asking, you know, let's say that about a third of the market is passive right now. My question is, what proportion of the market would need to be passive in order for the influence of passive investing to start being felt in stock prices? My personal answer would be north of 99%, but maybe I'm way too sanguine.
I have no idea, but what I do know is that we're talking about active investing, and we're talking the way Sanford talks about active investing is as if it efficiently allocates capital, like people aren't idiots. And I think that with the last two massive stock meltdowns, we saw Valiant and we saw SunEdison, which went bankrupt, the largest solar company in the world. Both of them had genius active investors piled into the stocks. It was a bad allocation of capital. Sometimes people are dumb. So that's something that we need to keep in mind here.
I also, just one last thing to kind of contradict myself from before, because I might as well. There is one half of this whole asset this whole capital allocation thing that we're kind of not even talking about.
Which
is the debt markets. Like, that is capital allocation, you know, bonds and lending people money.
But who wants to talk about bonds?
Yeah, and so in the same paper I was just citing to try and maybe feebly support the Sanford Bernstein thing, it actually finds that the size of bond markets and debt markets actually have more to do with the efficiency of capital, or it suggests that anyway. So we might actually be able to move to a 100% passive, worse than Marxism world, and still have decent capital allocation because of the debt markets.
So maybe let's just start a Kickstarter for the guy who wrote that report, and maybe he won't have to do things like that anymore.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Okay, so people, it's time for the numbers round. Lynette, did you bring a number?
I mentioned my number accidentally in the Mylan thing. It's like,
oh no.
I know. So my number is 2014.
Okay.
Because since 2014, EpiPen has made over $1 billion for Mylan. And that's like, the fuck are you raising the price for?
A lot of money.
Because they get to make $1 billion. This is capitalism, baby.
All right.
My number is 5 cents. It's a very small number. It's a tax. The state of Massachusetts is now going to tax every ride-hailing ride, like Uber or Lyft ride, essentially. It's slapping a 20-cent tax on it overall, some of which is just going to municipalities and the state. But 5 cents of that, of every ride, is going to be going to the taxi industry to subsidize it help it, you know, move on to a brave new technological future. And a lot of people have been up in arms about this, like, oh, you're trying to subsidize a dying industry. But to me, this is more, you know, it's only supposed to last for 5 years. And to me, this is more just kind of political horse trading to kind of like get the rest of this tax on and kind of normalize and regulate Uber and Lyft. And the 5 cents is just kind of a bone, it seems to me, that they're throwing to the taxi industry so that they don't get too angry about the stuff they didn't get in the bill, things like fingerprinting Uber drivers that they really wanted. So it's a kind of silly sounding tax, but I think in political economy terms, it's not the worst.
Okay.
My number is $10 billion, and this is my capital allocation number apropos the last segment. $10 billion is the amount of money that Apple is going to spend on R&D in 2016. That is bigger than the $7.7 billion budget of the National Science Foundation, and it is also bigger than the entire VC investment into every single Silicon Valley and San Francisco.
But how much is that as
combined?
A percentage of their revenue? And compared to Google, how does that stack up? Because I bet you it's not as much.
It's about 4% of revenue.
That's lower than other tech companies.
It's doubled over Tim Cook's 5 years at Apple. It's interesting that Apple under Steve Jobs actually invested a surprisingly low amount in R&D and was still incredibly innovative. Apple under Tim Cook has invested a lot more and hasn't been quite as obviously innovative, although we don't know what they
have. Buying ideas is more expensive. It's about buying ideas at this point.
I imagine some of this just has to be the car, right? I mean, like, because cars are so R&D. I mean, when I hear $10 billion R&D, that just sounds like, you know, auto industry kind of numbers.
Possibly. I don't know. Maybe. We should ask Elon Musk when he's not sleeping on the floor of the Gigafactory or writing love notes to Amber Heard.
So, oh yeah, and for those of us who need a refresher on jargon, R&D is research and development, which is basically the amount of money you spend on all those lost science, all those lost centers known as scientists and researchers and people who make the world a more intelligent place. Yeah.
They should put words in the internet for a living.
Yeah.
Really make some difference in the
world.
Yeah,
that's exactly. They should deal with a comments section. That's how they should spend their time.
Okay, that is it for us this week. Thank you for listening to Slate Money. Do subscribe to the show. You can find it by searching for Money in the iTunes store. If you want to look at all of the other Panoply podcasts in the iTunes store, you can go to itunes.com/panoply. Write to us. The email address is always slatemoney@slate.com. Many thanks to Virilyn Williams, the producer, and also to the executive producers, Steve Lichtai and Andy Bowers. And we will talk to you next week on Slate Money.